CRM podcasters, we have a special episode of the CRM podcast for you. If you'll notice, I'm not Chris. This is Doug, and I have taken over the podcast for this episode. We have Russell in Seattle.
Howdy.
We have Chris, who will be, for the first time, I think, a panelist instead of hosting this in Nevada.
Hey. That's true.
And we have the Dig Ventures crew and some secret hidden location somewhere in the UK.
Hi, guys. How are you?
Brilliant. So let's get started. Dig Ventures, you guys do crowdfunding, crowdsourcing. For some of the listeners who may not know, could you explain a little bit about that?
You go for it, Lisa.
All right, cool. Well, what we'd like to say, because there's still a lot of confusion about that over here in the UK as well, is that crowdfunding is about raising money. And crowdsourcing is about bringing bodies to your project. So in a way, you could say that crowdfunding is crowdsourced finance, but they are definitely two distinct things. And on our project, we combine them both. We crowdfund, so we raise money, and we also crowdsource in that people are able to come to site and participate in what we're doing.
Yeah, so we've been doing it since about 2012. We were involved a little bit before then too. And it's a shifting field, you know. There are new models being invented pretty much every week. But I think our approach sits very comfortably in what might be called the collaborative and digital economy. And these are new ways of approaching very staid industries. And we're applying some of those things that we see outside of archaeology, but applying them to our own field, and with some interesting results.
Great. And you guys have started your own company, Dig Ventures. And do you want to tell us a little bit about that?
Well, it's like an octopus, Doug. There's arms everywhere. We do our own crowdfunded archaeological field schools in the summers. We also run a crowdfunding platform, which we started actually so that we could run our own projects and then realized could be a real asset to the archaeology and heritage community. There's so many more projects now that are considering doing crowdfunding or crowdsourcing for their projects. And it's not, you know, heritage is not the same thing as sort of just going to Kickstarter and selling widgets. You know, every project is so distinct and has so many different variables when it comes to how the organization works, what the other resources are like. So we started the platform so that we could give people a little bit more help than just sort of, you know, rocking up and plopping your project down onto Kickstarter, which you can do without ever actually speaking to anyone, a human being. So we run the platform, and we, you know, we're a registered organization, which for the U.S. listeners basically means we're a commercial archaeology unit as well. So we fulfill contracts, you know, for other people. And that's pretty much it in a nutshell. It doesn't really describe what our daily life is like, because there's so many things coming at us all the time as the sector grows and changes that are really exciting, that are very much born out of the digital function of our business. So is there anything else you want to add?
Yeah, I think, you know, fundamentally, we're archaeologists. We're digging archaeologists. You know, that's what gets us out of bed in the morning, the thought that there might be another site to go at. And really, these interesting approaches are ways that we can do archaeology in a world where the finance is being turned off left, right and centre.
Yeah.
40% of the industry has lost their job over the last recession. And really, we wanted to find new ways to do what archaeologists have always done, and that's dig holes in the ground.
Nice. And you guys, you were mentioning a platform, and if I remember correctly, it's something I can't remember the name. It was Start Digging or Dig Now.
Yeah.
It's called Dig Starter, rather originally.
Yes.
It's called Dig Starter.
Yeah. I love it.
Well, you know, it does what it says on the tin, really.
Yes.
Could you guys tell us a little bit more about DigStarter.
Sure. Well, that's our Kickstarter, basically. And it we run it on the Dig Ventures website. And it is a crowdfunding platform, which we built so that we could use when we ran our first campaign for a site called Layston Abbey, rather than outsourcing it to Sponsum or Rocket Hub or Indiegogo or Kickstarter. We decided to pull it in-house. And, you know, we are very, you know, selective about the kind of projects that we take on our site. I don't want to use the word curate because it's a little bit, you know, wrong for this, but we are quite choosy because we're looking for projects that are about sustainability, that are not just looking for a quick fix for money that's now not coming from elsewhere. We don't want to replace grant funding so that, you know, we help somebody raise £5,000 and, you know, after they've spent it, they're back to exactly where they started. You know, it's not a replacement for that sort of grant cycle. But we do work with other organizations who want to do crowdfunding campaigns. Some of them do make it to launch and you'll see them out on our platform. Some of them don't, but they use the consultancy that we do with them as a useful exercise in sort of marketing and repositioning themselves organizationally in the digital space. You know, there's a lot of organizations in the heritage sector that maybe aren't as sophisticated yet as they could be in how they approach their digital and social identities and presence and their channels and how they use them. So obviously that's an essential part of a successful crowdfunding campaign. So we do a lot of work through people who contact us about the platform, about maybe doing crowdfunding, about supporting that kind of growth and, you know, digital skills in the heritage sector, which, you know, are utterly, utterly essential for us all now. So that's what the platform is. You know, we are working right now with three different campaigns that are in various states of being ready to launch or not launch. And, you know, we don't know until we really get to the end of it whether or not they'll be able to, because it is, you know, crowdfunding is hard work. And it's not necessarily about your project. You know, everybody's project is awesome. We're all awesome. We know that. But when you're doing crowdfunding, in order to be successful, you really need to flip that on its head and really think about what's in it for the crowd. So
that's the thing. You know, I mean, we tell people more often than not no rather than yes when it comes to, you know, coming on the platform, simply because they're not ready. They haven't quite grasped what crowdfunding is. And the least important thing about crowdfunding is the money. That's almost a secondary consideration. Really, it's about building a community of advocates who want to see your project succeed through the medium and longer term. And that's worth 10 times as much as the money, but it costs an awful lot to get it. And people, you know, many organizations, many archaeologists aren't ready yet to turn their projects inside out in a way that they have to become truly social. And so when we look at the money that you raise through a campaign, it's a barometer of how well and how social you're being, how social your project is, but it's not the most important thing at all.
Sounds great. I actually have a lot of questions, but I believe Chris has a couple of questions, or maybe just one as well.
Well, mine actually is related a little bit to the money, because I'm wondering how your guys' crowdfunding campaigns work. I mean, why would somebody go with you guys versus going with Kickstarter or Indiegogo? What's your cut, and what are the requirements? Like, if they want to raise $10,000 and they only raise $5,000, do they get the five, or does that go back, or, you know, how does all that work?
Yeah, well, we were absolutely starting this with our sector in mind, you know, so it's sort of an antidote to the impersonality and the sort of death by a thousand cuts now, as the crowdfunding market has gotten more sophisticated. You know, it started out that there was flat percentages, and then there were registration fees, and then the percentages have gone up. And, you know, what's in it for the people who register with us rather than using Kickstarter is that you do get part of what we do, and what we offer standard is a certain level of consultancy. You know, you have to be at least savvy enough to write a decent campaign and understand how that fits in with your organization in terms of resourcing it. And what are you going to do with that community of people who participate with you once the crowdfund is done? And you have to be able to put a video together and understand narrative and all of that, and understand your benefits. You know, we're a benefits-based crowdfunder It's not charity. It's definitely an exchange, a transactional exchange. And, you know, so we offer that basic support that you wouldn't get from Kickstarter or anybody else. You can just show up on the Kickstarter website and plop your campaign down and you're done. We don't necessarily believe that's right for the heritage and archaeology sector. So we take a much more personal approach.
There's probably a perception amongst people who haven't been involved in crowdfunding that, you know, on a site like Kickstarter, because it's got the most amount of traffic, that if they launched a campaign there, that they'd almost be guaranteed to reach their goal. In fact, it is quite the opposite. Nobody goes to Kickstarter to browse projects that they can fund. Yeah. It's a tool. Kickstarter are providing you with a tool, and you've got to do the work, the hard work, to make the tool work. So when you think about it that way, a niche platform like our own that's 100% focused on archaeology and heritage, managed by people who've been through the process and gone through every aspect of it, I think that's something that we can really give back to the sector.
Okay, cool.
Russell, you had a question?
Yeah, Doug. The Dig Venture folks, could you introduce yourself one more time? I know Lisa and then the other name?
Brendan.
Thank you for talking to us today.
Doug's here too.
John in the background. John, Brendan, Lisa, great. I just wanted to briefly mention, I work a little bit with the Ethics Bowl team, or the Ethics Bowl organizing committee for the SAAs here in the U.S., and we actually had an Ethics Bowl case study that was at least partially inspired by some of the work that y'all are doing.
Oh, my goodness.
And I believe it was actually debated, and it was really interesting to hear students' responses. But I had a couple questions for you on, it sounds like it, part of what you do is just give people best practices in crowdfunding and crowdsourcing, if they want to use that for their project, mistakes to avoid.
Yes.
Yeah.
Great. Do you see this kind of crowdfunding as a way to fill gaps in regular funding channels, like here in the U.S., NSF grants, especially for all sorts of anthropology and archaeology projects are really under fire right now. Is this a solution, part of a solution? What's your take on that? And then especially in the UK, how does it differ or not?
Well, that's a really good question. It's also a really complex question, and it's ever-changing. Crowdfunding is never going to be a replacement for the traditional funding streams. If it was going to be, it already would have happened, you know? And it's tricky in that you can't continue to do business in exactly the same way. You can't use crowdfunding money in exactly the same way that you would if you were taking in a grant, because you are beholden and you are visible and you are social in a much different way. You have this community of people who have supported you to reach your goal, and they are utterly, utterly part of the DNA of your project. So that will change the way that a project can function. And I understand that, you know, this creates some wrinkles for academic projects, for example, that aren't there with other kinds of funding.
So I think it's a complex one for us to answer, because if we say, yeah, that's great, then it's almost as if we put ourselves on the side of the politicians who want to slash services because they see that there's a viable alternative. And it puts us against some of our peers who are actually in the same boat as us, trying to make a more established footing for archaeology, trying to bring archaeology back to people to reconnect with that wellspring of public interest. All I can say is that there are so many different changes happening, technological changes, social changes happening in the world at the moment, fueled by the web, fueled by the turn to social, that it's our duty to try and engage with that, to take those changes and try and to apply them in an experimental, open way to what we do as archaeologists. It doesn't mean that it's going to replace state funding, but it does mean that we're at the table. We're engaging with how the world is working. I mean, every industry is meeting its Amazon at the moment, its Airbnb, or its Uber. You know, what would that look like for archaeology? What does disruptive innovation look like in archaeology? Well, we're only going to find out if we try some of these tools and apply them to what we do. And that's really where we see ourselves. We don't have all the answers, but we do have some of the questions.
Yeah. And I think as things are swinging ever more now towards needing to be able to prove and quantify somehow that word engagement, you know, which gives everybody the shivers, and be able to prove and understand impact, you know, another word that's giving people the shivers. Crowdfunding is a really powerful way of doing that, because everyone who funds you is actually voting for your idea. They're voting with their money, and then they're voting with their labor. And the people who don't participate through the crowdfunding get to hear about this stuff on a very localized basis, and then they can come along and be a part of it as well. It's very much making the whole citizen science buzzword thing. It's putting flesh on those bones, and you know we're seeing it happen sort of every time we run a crowdfund, and a lot of it is really unexpected. And, you know, at some point it would be fantastic to sit down and do a really strong piece of research around all that.
If we get time.
Yeah, if we get time. Yeah.
So, Russell, you had another question?
Yeah, I'll just do one more and then I'll let others speak for a little bit. Lisa,
just a little
forgive
bit.
Me, but just a little bit. I tend to go on these things. Lisa, forgive me, but your accent doesn't sound very, very much like the UK. Are you American by any chance?
I sure am.
Yeah. There you go.
Red, white, and blue.
Well, am I the odd one out here then? Am I?
You are. People in other.
I'm originally from upstate New York, via Manhattan, and then via the Institute of Archaeology in London.
Nice.
Very neat. Lisa, just kind of given that background of seeing how CRM works in both sides of the world, and then also the crowdfunding approach, do you think the approach that you're taking with Dig Ventures is something that is workable in the United States, given like Archaeological Resources Protection Act, kind of the looting climate, contracts with CRM, between CRM companies and then their clients where sometimes information is confidential? Is that something you think could fly, or is just an alternative?
Yeah, I think there are different complications for you guys. One of the ones that I, you know, have been thinking about quite a lot when we're thinking about trying to crack the USA, you know, as all good pop stars need to, is that it's the vastness of it. You know, what works for us over here is being able to lock and load a community of interest. And, you know, we're dealing with a much smaller area, although, of course, we're all over the world now. Our supporters come from all over the world. And one of the things about the States is that, you know, it's just the hugeness of it. You know, how would you accomplish that? How would you bring that community of interest to bear enough to actually get something done after you had located a site where it would be okay to dig and okay to publicize and okay to do all of those things that you need to do to successfully crowdfund? So I haven't quite got my head around it all the way yet.
Hey everyone, ArchaeWebby here, or just Webby to my friends and people that read my last name wrong, which happens a lot. I want to let you know about a project I'm working on that will bring great content like the CRM Archaeology Podcast to your earbuds or work truck speakers in massive quantities. Often on our show, we wish we could just get into certain topics a little more, and we honestly never have the time. There's so much to talk about, and quite frankly, it's hard to get Steven to stop talking when he goes on a rant. To answer this need, I want to start a podcasting network. So I'm cleverly calling this podcasting network the Archaeology Podcasting Network, or APN. For this idea to work, we need show hosts, editors, and funding. We need company sponsors, and we're not opposed to ads from companies that make the products archaeologists use every day. To get started, we need pilot episodes with people that are dedicated to this idea. We've already shot a couple, but we need a bunch more. We've got some show ideas, so contact me if you are interested. Once we get this going, we want episodes to come out once a week, or once every 2 weeks, ideally. If we're successful, then hosts and editors will be paid for their time. I wouldn't ask anyone but myself to do this for free. So if you're interested, send me an email to ArchaeoWebby, that's ArchaeoWebby @gmail.com. Or use the contact form on the website at digtech-llc.com/podcast.
Chris is actually starting an interesting project, and I'll let him talk about it. But one of the ideas to get it off the ground is to possibly do some crowdfunding. So I'll let Chris explain it a little bit, and then it'd be great to hear what your guys' thoughts on it, because it is also a bit collaborative as well and a bit of crowdsourcing. So I'll let Chris talk about that.
Cool.
Okay. You know, before I get too far into it too, let me ask another question to you guys based on your platform. Are you like, what's the flexibility on the projects you're funding? Does it have to be anything related to, say, archaeology or heritage conservation or something like that? Or, you know, or does it has to be like an excavation or some sort of project? Because what we're trying to do is more of an educational online website, which I'll talk about in a minute. But, you know, just let me know the limitations, so to speak, of your platform.
They're broad. They're broad strokes. Anything within the archaeology and heritage sector, but most particularly what we care about is how the community will be incorporated and what the participation level is for the people who fund you. Mm-hmm. And also whether or not the money really is helping you as a springboard to capture other sources of funding, you know, really seed funding in the truest sense of the word.
So we have a tagline on our website, archaeology in your hands. And that's what we ask ourselves every time a proposal comes across our desk. Does this put archaeology in people's hands? You know, is it that kind of social driven project that we do ourselves, and is this the kind of thing that will gain traction with our audience? And sometimes it doesn't, so we go back to people and work through other approaches, work through other plans, and it's all a process. So it depends what you got. I'm interested to hear more about it.
Well, I will say, not even a little bit of self-promotion here, but the episode we just released today of the CRM Archaeology Podcast, we have about a 20-minute discussion on what this is. So for more in-depth information, go listen to episode 44. And but for now, I'll let you know, it's something that Doug and Bill, one of the other hosts of the podcast, and I are putting together. And it's an idea I had really years ago, based on my own ignorance, when I first got into this job and not knowing little things, that really, you know, everybody's afraid to ask questions. You don't learn that it's okay to ask questions until you've already asked all the questions or you've muddled through and just learned things on the job. And right. So what we want to set up is an educational resource that's more of a one-stop shop for everything related to archaeology, anthropology, and in fact, I was calling it Field Tech Incorporated because I liked the way the name sounded, but Bill came up with a better title that's a little more well-rounded, and that's Heritage Conservation. And we're still going with Incorporated until I figure out how we're going to register this business, probably next week. But anyway, Heritage Conservation is what we're going with, and it's basically a website where you go to the website, you need a certain piece of information, whether it's something in regulations or artifact identification or how to set up and use your compass or how to use or little things like setting up a 1 meter by 1 meter excavation unit, how to do that, you know, what's involved in that, and everything you can possibly think of in bite-sized little chunks where you go take a quick test, you get a certificate number that can be verified by your employer or whoever you give the number to. You can put that on your resume or on your LinkedIn profile or wherever you want. And you go to our website to verify the certificate, and the courses are super cheap. I mean, we're talking $5, maybe $5 US, and then with discounts for larger packages, because they're super quick, they're super easy. There's going to be a test involved, but that's open book, and you take it as many times as you need to pass it. Yeah. And then you're certified for theoretically the field season, so 6 to 8 months. And then next year, you take tests over again for actually what you're going to need that year, because people working in this country, you know, you could work in the Southwest one season, you could work in the upper Midwest the next season, on the East Coast the season after that, and then half of that season work on the Pacific Coast doing coastal archaeology. So it's handy to be able to go to someplace and learn about the area real quick with really bite-sized modules that you can show your employer, listen, I was proactive and I did this, and you know, I've got this this quick knowledge. So that's what we want to set up, but that's going to take money to set up, and probably lots of it. So that's what we're talking about, crowdfunding.
Yeah, I wouldn't, I you know, I don't think it would take that much apart from your own time. I mean, if you look at how we set ourselves up with nothing. And that's really the whole change in this kind of collaborative economy where we're now pitched. It's look, you know, not the build it and they will come thing is over. It's dead in the water. It's, you know, build it as you're flying it and hope you don't hit the ground. And this is where crowdfunding comes in. You know, it allows you to set up projects without any funds to begin with. All you've got to do is try and build the crowd. So when we set Dig Ventures up, we were both working in full-time employment. And it's only over the course of the last 3 years that firstly one of us has come on board full-time, then the second one. And now we have a team of five and a whole bunch of other freelancers who join us on all our projects. So it can be very, very easy. There are tools out there, various LMS systems that, you know, WordPress plugins and so on, which I imagine could be absolutely perfect for what you've got there, you know.
Well, we might have to have a longer conversation with you guys over the next couple of weeks.
I think so.
Yeah, because honestly, I mean, I'd heard of Dig Ventures, I think. Well, I've been hearing about you guys since you started online and in social media and stuff, which is a good thing. If I'm sitting here in Reno, Nevada, and I heard about you guys, then you must be doing something right with your marketing and advertising.
It's a little bit mind-blowing, really.
Yeah.
Yeah, so because I had talked to another person about this that's been in the nonprofit sector with the Maya Research Program for about 15 years. And, you know, we talked to her about crowdfunding, and she said, and I don't know if she knows about Dig Ventures. I might have to let her know about that. But I'd actually set up an Indiegogo account because I was going to go with them to do this. But then we thought, you know, I've got a pretty big social network. Doug has a pretty big social network. Bill has a pretty big social network. And between the three of us, we accomplished one of the main things that a crowdfunding site would do for somebody, which is, you know, give them a platform to speak on. And we have that. Yes. But going through something like Dig Ventures that's specifically designed for this really, really does make sense, even if we have the ability to do it on our own website. Yes. Just having a one stop where, I mean, this is what I do. I'm trying to make a podcast network where all podcasts are in one place, and an educational thing where everything is like there is in one place. Why not have all the crowdfunded archaeology projects in one place?
That's what we
love it.
Every time we see another one on Indiegogo, we're like, rats.
Yeah. It makes sense. Nice. I mean, the job there, you hit on it really, is you've got to extend outside of your first and second order contacts until you hit that third rung and beyond. So you already bring that to the table. And what you'll be doing then is connecting with other projects that have come on our platform and our own crowd as well. And by degrees, the crowd grows and you connect with people who are already vested in the kind of work that you're doing and could very well easily become advocates for your projects too. It's a circle. It's a virtuous circle.
So I have a couple of questions, and they're a bit all over the place, so we'll just work our way through them. You guys had mentioned now you're a group of five, I believe, is what you said?
Yes.
Could you tell us a bit about who else is involved in Dig Ventures?
Sure.
Yeah, well, we recently received a grant from HLF to develop our most recent project, which is Digital Dig Team, which we're going to be shouting from the rooftops about starting this autumn. But it so we hired a community manager, and her name is Maya. And HLF is the Heritage Lottery Fund over here, and they are the major funding body that support the heritage and archaeology sector over here. So we received a grant from them of £75,000 to do this project. And Maya. So Maya is our community manager, and she is really the sort of hub around which all of our social media and community news hub revolves around. And then we have Kezia, who is our community archaeologist, and works really closely with Brendan on producing the site reports, and also is really entrenched in data management for the Digital Dig Team system and reaching out to other community archaeology projects. I mean, we're fascinated with other examples of how people are approaching what we're doing. And we have a voracious appetite for hearing about it. And Kezia is really good about you know, sort of reaching out and finding those things. And then we have also Raksha Dave, who used to be on Time Team, who is one of the world's best archaeologists. She could dig anywhere. We could drop her on the moon and she could dig it. And she's fantastic with people, and she runs our field schools in the summers. And we also have Emily, who is our operations manager. She's a ninja, and we really use her when we've got complex moving pieces, you know, a couple of sites running at different times, and we need the diggers to be showing up in the right place at the right time, which Brendan and I would no doubt probably fail at miserably. So we have a ninja, when I think every team should have a ninja. Absolutely. And that's Emily. And we have the dog, of course, Site Dog, who has his own Twitter feed.
Yeah.
And as in charge of lots of things when we're on site.
Yeah, runs the show, really. Cool.
Excellent. So I guess I'll ask another question about some other, I'm not sure if you guys have contact with the other crowdfunding heritage people, so Common Sites and mm-hmm. MicroPass just launched recently. Do you guys, yeah. is there a club of crowdfunding archaeologists that you all sit down and talk at?
Yeah, well,
sadly no, but I mean, we know Sherrod from Common Sites, and we're on the advisory board for MicroPass.
Yeah. It's funny that they're a different proposition. I mean, we're all kind of broadly under the same umbrella, but it's a different approach to the thing. Ours is very crowd based. You know, we're unashamedly about the crowd. The AHRC research project that is MicroPass is trying some really interesting stuff, and layered on top of that is a very detailed evaluation. So it's much more of an academic project, trying to gain insights that can then be presented and published and given back to the discipline. So it's a different approach. We're all under the same umbrella. We all get on. And,
unless we think we do.
Yeah,
Who knows what they say about us?
Yeah, absolutely. But I think that it's great to see that kind of competition springing up, because it really helps you define your own value proposition and helps people understand that, you know, what's different about yourselves. So.
Excellent. Chris, you had a couple of questions?
Yeah, I'm wondering, so getting into this, what does, and again, my own self-interest here at play, but what does somebody have to do to get started with you guys? What is the procedure? What do they need? What kind of information do they need to get started? And who do they contact?
Okay, so normally, you know, if it's not somebody we've met somewhere, they just send us a blind email to the info@digventures.com and say, I've got this idea, I'm thinking about crowdfunding it, you know, what do I have to do? And then I generally respond and say, well, tell us a little bit more about your project. And then we'd move on to a Skype call, you know, so that we can really get some understanding of what the goals are and where that participation is really going to kick in and how to help make that happen and whether or not the project will be, you know, overburdened by trying to do something like that. We do spend quite a lot of time telling people not to crowdfund, actually. because it is a lot more work, I think, than a lot of people realize. And for smaller organizations or for people who aren't already social and don't understand how that all works, it can be mind boggling. But then after that, it really is, we have a set amount of like a set format for copy for the website. Mm-hmm. We'll generally sign an MOU, which will detail the finances of it, which are very, very simple. We operate on we're not all or nothing. So you can keep what you raise. Mm-hmm. And it's a 4%. We take 4% if you're successful in reaching your goal. And we take 9% if you're not, which is the sort of very simple and easy arrangement that most crowdfunding platforms had when we launched ours. As I've mentioned, things have sort of moved on from there, and there's listing fees and, you know, Kickstarter in some cases is charging people 15% now. And, you know, the platform is not meant to be a massive money spinner for us. It's not really even factored in as that. It's more about creating this community and bringing, you know, as you were saying, the archaeology and heritage crowdfunding projects into one place so that we can all learn from each other, you know, so that we can help each other and create a place where if somebody wants to be a part of something, they know where to go to look for it.
So we've actually just had Sarah join us. Sarah, can you hear us? Nope, I don't think.
Yeah.
Oh. There we go.
Oh, Sarah's in an explosion.
Sorry, I'm trying to get to a quieter spot.
Well, I'll just do a quick Sorry. Introduction. Sarah is one of the other podcast panelists who's been on, well, since the beginning. Lisa and Brendan are from Dig Ventures. And so we've just been asking them a couple of questions about crowdfunding and all that wonderful stuff. But Sarah, not to put Sarah on the spot, I actually have another question that we'll probably go with just now, if you guys don't mind. You've done a couple of crowdsourcing or crowdfunding projects. So if you were to give one piece of advice, I know you've said you actually try to discourage a lot of people from doing it, but if there was to be like one lesson that you've learned from all the experience, what would you tell the listeners? What's one of the things you guys have learned, or one of the most important things? Anything along those lines?
Doug, you're awful. It's so hard. just that it is, you know, if you don't know, if you're not ready to have a whole new community of people involved with you, don't do crowdfunding. It's not easy money in any way, shape, or form. It's not easy to get your campaign up and in front of people. It's not easy to design benefits that are good for your project and good for the crowd. And it's very difficult when you have, you know, a bunch of people who have really, you know, put their money down on your dream, to not have something in place to make sure that those people are, you know, they get not only the benefits fulfilled, but that they're looked after and they can be involved with what you're doing.
I struggle to find the one thing, the irreducible thing. It's a completely changes the sort of definition of the self, your self definition of as an archaeologist, turns it inside out. And I find that really liberating. Instead of having one client who's paying for the excavation or one grant body to whom I'm beholden, I have 250 people, and it means that everything I do has to be completely public-facing, completely open, and that's led to some fantastic insights, some fantastic new ways of doing things, which I've never looked back from. But I tell you this, it's not an easy way out.
Yeah.
Chris, you had a question?
Yeah, I'm going to ask this because I'm looking on your website right now, and I'm going to ask this because I imagine a lot of our audience is actually in the United States, you know, just because we're a CRM archaeology podcast, and that's what we call it here. So, and I know we have members all across the world, too, or people that listen. But that being said, the projects that I see on your website here look like they're mostly in the UK, and I see dollars in – well, I see prices in pounds and things like that. Is your platform flexible enough to obviously make that dollars or some other currency, or you know, how does that work if somebody comes from either the United States or, let's say, I don't know, Australia or China?
Yeah, we actually worked with the Archaeological Conservancy, which is a U.S.-based organization really early on.
Yeah. So it's really about the payment gateways. I mean, we use PayPal, so that you can use any currency you like. We're just about to go through a changeover on our website in the next month. There's a whole complete redesign we're very excited by. And we're likely to use a different payment gateway, Stripe, in that instance, which means that you instantly get the money that comes through, and any percentages get taken off at source and what have you. So the field's moving on. It's completely open to any currencies. You can set a project up in any currency and so on. So if you have a project that you're running in the US and that you can create that in dollars, and you'll receive dollars instantly as soon as people contribute towards your project.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Cool. I like it.
Good stuff.
Sorry.
No, go for it, Sarah.
I hate to do this. I just need to recap. Have we asked them about their use of technology in the field and any difficulties they may have had by having all of their data open source and live streamed, basically?
No, we haven't. So please.
Whoa.
Sorry.
Yeah, the only difficulty is getting a connection, a Wi-Fi connection.
Yeah.
Which it's an interesting question. I mean, we developed this. We decided to ditch the paper archive in its entirety, and record everything on iPads, which instantly uploads that to a cloud-based relational database, and then feeds that to social profiles of all the excavators that are digging, and to the main website itself. Super cool. We've been in beta testing with that over the course of the summer, and as part of this web design, this web launch that we're talking about, that's all going to come out of beta testing, and we're going to be screaming it from the rooftops. But the main issue really is. Is connectivity, and there are ways around that, which we travel with four different SIM cards for every single network, but ultimately the next phase of development will be a offline app that can record and then dump data as soon as it hits a network connection, and we've done all the hard work in order to get to that place. It's going to be a small step to get to the point where we can do that.
So Russell had to step away from the microphone to take care of his children, but he had a quick question about what sort of database tools do you guys use? You probably didn't know this, but Russell is working with Chris on an app to do recording in the field, and so he's very technical minded. So
yeah. That's great. Well, we use, in effect, everything we use is open source, and, from WordPress onwards. And we use an open source recording system called the Archaeological Recording Kit, which was developed by LP Archaeology. And they've been working as part of our development team to get a digital dig team up and running. And basically, it's a PHP interface with a MySQL database. Back end, and that's nested within a WordPress site that manages all the social aspects to it, our timeline, our dig diary, our videos that get streamed through, and all that kind of thing. And the two of them are basically two sides to the same coin. And work together. It's responsively designed. It works on all devices, from a mobile phone through to a tablet. In fact, anything connected to the internet. It's super cool. We're so excited by it, and have so many plans for unleashing it on the world.
Yeah.
Sounds great. To sort of move slightly away from technology, unless anyone else has any questions on that, you guys had mentioned, so with crowdfunding, you end up with tiers and different rewards for, donations. So, someone gives $100 and they get a certain reward for wherever the project is. Have you guys run into good examples, bad examples, personal experience, anything along those lines of you could share?
Yeah, I mean, without wanting to drop anyone in it, let's just say that we've seen projects that are just not very smart about it, like really look at your resources. There's no need to offer levels at a pound, or at a dollar, for example. There's so much research out there that sort of shows that the people who want to be a part of what you're doing will want to be a part of it, regardless of whether or not you offer something quite that low, you know what I'm saying? And we do quite a lot of help in terms of helping people to make things simpler. You don't need 20 different levels of benefit. You don't need to satisfy every single thing that somebody may want, keep it very, very simple. Keep it really tied to, maybe things that your organization offers already, or that might be useful that you could throw in the shop maybe afterward, or that really are tied to what is uniquely about your organization. When the Dover Boat did their crowdfund, one of the really great things that they did is they offered I think it was 500 quid, about you could like ride on the boat or something. If it was me doing that campaign, I might have dropped that down a bit and made it a little bit more accessible, and then perhaps maybe more people might have been able to take advantage of that. You know, we've seen some crowd funds, for example, where sites didn't offer a participatory level, and that could have been because they didn't think they could handle the extra people, or it was because of regulatory stuff. But then there are other creative ways around that. I think the worst kinds of benefits are the ones that just really are sort of tokenistic and not thought through at all.
Yeah, a thank you from our team, that kind of thing. You know, that's missing the point. It's not about you know, the crowd, and we spend a lot of time explaining these things to people who come on the platform. And of course, you get a spikes in benefit levels. There's an average donation that many people go for. It's in about the 40 to 60 quid mark. So it means that you should load up your benefits really around that area. If you want to make the most of your campaign. So it's not a one-size-fits-all, but there are some tricks of the trade, you might call them, that we've learned the hard way.
Excellent. So I have a question, and I'll give a little background to the readers. In the UK, there's an organization, the Institute for Archaeologists, and it's the professional body. It's a slight mix between the SAA and RPA in the States. But you can get what they call registered organizations, ROs, and that are organizations that agree to certain standards. And I believe Dig Ventures is the first. So you guys are better describing what you are and how you're the first crowd. I know you are the first ones to do crowdfunding and organization, but could you describe your relationship to the IFA and a bit about that process and how it's worked out being one of these, an RO that's basically not a commercial unit? You're not a CRM company. Well, not a traditional CRM company, I should say.
That's right. Well, it was really important to us that that the work as archaeologists that we were doing, even though we come from this very innovative approach to the funding model and the way that we run our projects, it was really important to us that the quality of our archaeology was recognised on a par with all our peers. So we became the first exclusively community-focused registered organisation in the IFA for that reason. And we think that it's vitally important that, you know, although we're trying these new approaches and others may come through doing the same, that doesn't in any way detract from the quality of the archaeological results, because ultimately that's what we're here to do. So that was our main motivation for doing it.
Yeah. And I mean, for the American listeners, the Institute for Archaeologists, you know, as Doug is referring to as the IFA, at the moment, it's a voluntary organization. You know, it's not a legal entity that has the right to enforce these kinds of standards. So in a way, the profession here is faced with, you know, having to really protect itself, and everyone has to sort of sign up to upholding those standards. And, you know, in a country as small as the UK, with such different sets of circumstances as a result of that, I think it's really important that those things are upheld. And one of the reasons why we did go for registered organization status and why we're both members is because, you know, until we're all pulling that forward and really pushing hard for, you know, for better paying conditions for archaeologists here who are working in CRM type companies, then, you know, the whole sector is going to struggle. And that is, you know, one of our main priorities is to try to help be a part of whatever solution might present itself, which is, you know, a subject for a whole other podcast. But I just sort of wanted to say that was also one of the reasons it's a kite mark, but we also really believe that it's important to have that kind of protection for the sector.
Mm. So how has the sector responded to this sort of, basically you have a very new model recording digitally. I know other units have done that, but you've really pulled together a bunch of different things, crowdsourcing, crowdfunding, you know, digital recording, how has that gone down? Have you got lots of inquiries? Have you got negative feedback? How's it going?
Yeah.
Well, my therapist will let you know.
Yeah, it's exhilarating. Let's put it that way. The forward momentum is such that it's, we try not to pay attention to much in a way of negative comments. But we do have a few of those, and often it comes from people, mid-careerists who are trying to establish themselves in a very old way of doing things, and what we represent is a threat, and sometimes they almost misinterpret what our motivation and misinterpret what we're doing. And that can be disappointing to catch some of that those comments and so on. But we're so committed to looking outside of our discipline for inspiration, that we try not to allow any detractors pull us back down. I mean, ultimately, this might not play well with your American audience, but I read the other day that over 8,000 people work for Jamie Oliver. He's one of our celebrity chefs. Well, as Doug knows, about half that number work in the entirety of British archaeology. I think you've got to kind of take it in perspective. We are a small discipline, but we punch well above our weight in terms of public interest and so on. What we're trying to do is reconnect with that, and then somehow use that the wellsprings of that public interest to fund and drive what we do as archaeologists.
Sounds great. I believe Sarah has a question for you about volunteer diggers.
Yeah.
Did Chris have a question before me, though?
Go ahead, Sarah.
Okay, so I was just wondering, because I was looking over your website and I saw that you guys have a profile up for most of your staff and I think all of your volunteers.
Yes.
So my question was, and I'm not trying to get negative feedback here at all. Yeah. How did you guys go about making sure that the quality of work was going to be up to par using volunteers who may or may not be trained? And I'm sure the app had a lot to do with that, but how did you guys basically quality control the data you were collecting and the work that was being done?
Well, it means that we've got to have a lot more trained archaeologists in the trench than you might expect on a normal community project. So, for instance, our numbers, our ratio is about 1-2 in terms of professional archaeologists to volunteers or venturers, as we call them. So we spend a lot more time, a lot more energy, working alongside people in the trenches to guarantee that the data that you get is on a par. And we have to do that because the sites that we've been lucky enough to excavate are some of the most important in the UK. They're known as scheduled ancient monuments, and they carry with them the highest level of heritage protection in the UK. It means that everything we do has to be looked over by English Heritage, and everything has to be heavily project designed. And if we weren't absolutely shipshape in all of that, then they would, in effect, revoke our license to dig the site. It means that we've got to spend a lot more energy on supervision. But we believe that, the rewards that come back from that, far exceed what we have to put in.
So overall, did you have a positive experience working with the volunteers then?
Absolutely.
Yeah, I mean, it's crazy. It's almost like we created a little family around what we do now. And we have people coming back from New Zealand and Australia, and they're meeting people from down the road from the site. People separated from the other side of the globe, but sharing the same drive, the same life experiences that have brought them to archaeology later on. So it's tremendous, and it's a great thing as an archaeologist to be able to work in an environment where your skills and experience are so receptive. Really enjoyable.
Well, I'm glad that you guys included, I'm glad you guys did that, because I think it's proven something to the rest of the archaeological community that you really can take basically common people, put them on a dig site, and get quality work from it. Yeah. So I think that's awesome that you guys did that and you're documenting it. So
cool.
Thank you.
Chris, you had a question?
Yeah, I was wondering if you guys have done enough enough projects so far to get a sense on what works and what doesn't work. What's been some of the successful elements of some of the campaigns, and what did people try that they thought would work, but just they just didn't get funded enough, and maybe it was a problem in their approach. Who knows? Is there anything you can tell people to include in their projects to maybe help them be successful?
Well, one of the things that is that really comes up for me right away when you say that is realistic goals. You know, we just recently worked with Save Britain's Heritage on a campaign where, you know, we decided to take a punt on a 40 grand goal, which was enormous. But, you know, they are a campaigning organization, and they had some really good links into the sort of Ringo Starr celebrity Beatles tour people. So we thought, you know, perhaps they'd really get that third and fourth circle liftoff where, you know, they'd be able to reach a goal like that, but it didn't happen. So, you know, I would say keep your goals reasonable, would be my first, you know, bit of advice. And another thing that we see that works really well is, you know, just the language that people use to communicate is so important. You know, I mean, a lot of these projects really fall down because they still don't know how to really understand who their audience is and who they're speaking to. You know, the sort of academy expects us as scientists and archaeologists to constantly have the worthy aspects of our projects, you know, front and center. And all of that is everywhere through what Dig Ventures does, but we're not afraid to talk to people as we would talk to each other and, you know, share the excitement of what we're actually doing. And I would say that the biggest place where people fall down is to not tap into that and to be so overcautious in their communications that they can't communicate the excitement and things just fall flat.
Okay.
Well, that wraps up this this week's special episode of CRM Podcast. I'd like to thank Lisa and Brendan for being on. It was great to have you guys.
Thanks very much.
Yep, anytime.
And as per usual, we'll do our outro with everyone saying goodbye, but with a lot of pauses, because I know Chris doesn't like that. So see you all later.
Okay.
All
right. Yep. Cheers. Lots of pauses.
Bye. Yeah. Bye.
Bye.
Was that it? Was that the outro, Doug?
Yeah, that was the outro. That didn't go as well.
One of the worst outros ever.
Doug's a little new at the hosting side of things. And by the way, if you could go listen to episode 44, the one I just put out today, just scroll all the way to the end and you'll understand what I'm talking about. The last all 5 right. seconds.
Yeah, we have a tradition of Chris says goodbye and there's usually a long pause. Somewhat
only for
awkward.
Doug.
And everyone all at once.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, our outros don't quite line up.
Just listen to this one, Doug. Just listen to it.
All right. Bye. All right.
That's it for another episode of the CRM Archaeology Podcast. Links to some of the items mentioned on the show are in the show notes for the podcast, which can be found at www.digtech-llc.com/podcast. If you like the show and want to comment, please do. You can leave comments about this or any other episode on the website or on the iTunes page for this episode. You can also email me at archeowebby@gmail.com or use the contact form on the podcast webpage. If you'd like us to answer a question on a future episode, email me at archeowebby@gmail.com. Again, use the contact form on the podcast page of the website or tweet your questions using the hashtag CRMArchPodcast. Please share the link to the show wherever you saw it. If you share CRM archaeology related items on Twitter or Facebook, be sure to use the hashtag CRMArch so the community can see it and comment on it. If you'd like to subscribe to this podcast, you can do so on iTunes or on Stitcher Radio. You can also type the name of the podcast into your favorite podcasting app and subscribe that way.